Okay, thank you. Thank you for the invitation and the opportunity to speak here at this conference. So I'm going to talk about, well, very broadly titled talk, the dynamical strong field regime of general relativity. Okay, great, there's a laser pointer. And so this is going to be sort of actually part one of, you can almost think of it as a two-part talk on using this amazing observation that LIGO gave us a few months ago, GW150914, to try to test general relativity in the dynamical strong field. So I'm going to focus on some aspects that are related to exotic compact objects, alternatives to black holes within general relativity. And then Nico Yunes is going to be talking a lot more about particular alternative theories of gravity. I should also mention that this is work done in conjunction with Nico and Ken Tyagi. Okay, so this is sort of the outline of it, of the talk. So I would first just take a few minutes to just give my sort of two cents on the dynamical strong field, where we are, and how sort of astonishing this observation has been for studies of the strong field. Essentially, it's really sort of opened up a whole new area of research. And then what I'm going to do next is, before sort of looking at alternatives, I'm going to sort of describe what I think is, what, let me say, sort of the first, or the zeroth order evidence of the no-hair theorems of general relativity. So sort of rehashing what Aaron said already in a slightly different way, so I hope I don't bore you by going over the same things in a slightly different way, but I'll try and present it with a different perspective and hopefully argue to you that this really is a test of general relativity, the dynamics of Kerr black holes, in particular that we can think of this as the first, not very precise, but the first piece of evidence for Kerr black holes, the no-hair properties, and in fact the dynamics of black holes in the strong field regime. And then I will discuss the implications for testing relativity or constraining exotic alternatives to GR. One of the sort of perhaps one of the takeaway points as well will be that at the moment, the kinds of constraints that we can place on alternatives is actually a little bit weak. This event it's by no means the fault of this event. It's really the fault of our knowledge of alternative theories. You know, this is an amazing piece of data. It's got a very high signal to noise. We should be able to say a lot about alternatives, but we can't. And the reason is we just don't understand alternative theories in this regime, so we don't really have a quantitative way to test it. So that's why I've sort of said here that eventually this, I think, this piece of data is eventually going to be a game changer once we can understand alternatives a bit better. So we don't even have to wait for more exciting discoveries from LIGO, but we're all anxiously awaiting that. But this event by itself is going to, over the years, become more and more significant in these regards. Okay, so here's my brief reflections on the history of this dynamical strong field regime of relativity. So of course it was discovered basically at the same time that Einstein published his field equations. They note that within a couple of months afterwards, Schwarzschild had discovered the solution, it communicated with Einstein. It was actually only published a year later, but he had actually discovered it within a couple of months. And of course, within a few years, there were also cosmological solutions. So I'm not going to say much about cosmology. This is sort of a cosmology conference as well. But the one thing just to point out is that in terms of the dynamical strong field, so if you want to think of it as the regime where the field equations are most non-linear, the most unexpected phenomena might arise. And in general relativity, perhaps you can think of non-linearity as being the field equations become so non-linear that singularities form or existed in the past. So space and time become singular in some sense. So of course, in black holes, there are singularities. And of course, in cosmological solutions, you might think, well, say, okay, who knows what exactly happened in the very early universe, but just take the Friedmann-Robertson-Walker Lemaître cosmologies. They started in a big bang, which is a singularity. But actually, more significantly, I think that cosmological solutions are in the strong field regime on sizes of the Hubble scale anytime throughout the entire evolution of the universe. It's not just at the singularity where the strong field dynamics is important. And just to convince yourself of that, just imagine, let's say, taking an asymptotically flat space, take some form of energy with the density of the present energy density of the universe, which is not very much, and start adding up that amount of matter in spherical shells, By the time you get to a ball the size of the Hubble radius, you'll form a black hole in asymptotically fat space. So on those scales, cosmology is always in the strong field regime at any time. It's not just at a big bang or a big crunch. So perhaps, you know, I won't say too much about this here, but in terms of, you know, perhaps trying to understand dark energy in particular, these observations, or the confirmation of relativity in the strong field regime that we can get from LIGO, that might be able to inform us in some sense, especially if, you know, if you think, well, relativity is a scale-free theory, so what it says on scales of sizes of kilometers relevant to stellar mass black holes might also be relevant on those scales. Okay, so very soon after Einstein published the equations, the strong field regime was revealed through some of these exact solutions. But then what I'm calling sort of the dark ages happened in the next few decades, where, especially with black hole solutions, they were misunderstood, misinterpreted, or just dismissed as being irrelevant. And it's perhaps not unsurprising that, you know, that some of the consequences were so extreme, and there wasn't thought that the kind of densities, at least for stellar mass objects, might exist in the universe. So it's perhaps not surprising that they were misunderstood. But there was at least a period where this regime of relativity wasn't appreciated at all. So the Renaissance happened, perhaps starting in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and it happened on two fronts simultaneously. And it's sort of really important that it did occur in that way, especially for where we are today. And one was on the theoretical side, where, you know, through very, very, very many people working on this, we really truly understood what black holes were, the nature of singularities, how they arise in gravitational collapse. And of course, if that's all that it was, you know, then perhaps from a mathematical relativity perspective, this part of the theory, you could say, okay, we've cleaned it up, we've now understood what this is. But it would have just been, it would have stayed an interesting part of mathematical relativity. But why it has become so relevant today is on the observational side, you know, objects were discovered, you know, quasars, well, neutron stars was perhaps also a first discovery, where strong field gravity is important. But many objects were discovered in the universe that seemed to require this regime of the theory of relativity to explain. So in this time frame, it was realized that this part of the field equations, which was thought to be irrelevant, is actually very relevant to describing what's going on in the universe. After that, I'm almost saying that there was sort of an inverse dark ages. I think that perhaps the theorists and astronomers back in that time did their job a bit too well. We understood black holes to a point where they became, instead of being these sort of mysterious objects, they became things that were obvious, self-evident. You know, the theory is so beautiful, with you know, putting quantum mechanics and Hawking's discovery of Hawking radiation and opening up that whole side of things where, you know, the theory of black holes has almost been a Rosetta Stone for trying to understand quantum gravity, information loss, etc. That in some sense we started taking them for granted. And I think before this event, I would argue that in some sense we were taking, you know, these astonishing predictions of general relativity almost as if it had to be there. But the evidence prior to this, I would say, is very strong but circumstantial. So there's no doubt that there are dark compact objects out there that are consistent with black holes, but there is not, until this event, there's no evidence that they are the Kerr black holes of relativity, or that their dynamics is as described by the Einstein field equations. So of course that all changed with this discovery. Again, you've all seen this many times, so I'll just go on. So I'll just focus on the things that are sort of relevant to what I want to say. So as Aaron very nicely described, the phases of the merger. So these are the signals that were observed. You can sort of see this chirping, the in spiral, reaching this crescendo when they coalesce, and then the ring down. The other thing that on this, so this plot contains so much information, but the one particular thing that I want to focus on next is now thinking of, is this consistent with relativity? So of course this is just the raw data. And of course one thing that was so amazing about this event is, and no one quite expected that LIGO would see this, we thought we might have to wait for LISA, is that we could actually see this without match filtering. So this is really the raw data, just with some band pass and notch filtering, I believe. But the point is that there's no theory going into reconstructing the signal. So none of the knowledge about black holes went into reconstructing this. That's down here. So that's now saying, okay, we see this signal, it's a gravitational wave, how do we interpret it? Then we use our templates to interpret it. But now in terms of testing relativity, so is this consistent with general relativity? That's these two little lines over here. And so essentially what LIGO did was they say, well, let's now interpret this with, assuming relativity is correct, the best for templates. Let's subtract this from the signal. What do we get? This is this residual. And this residual is now consistent with noise. And so I say that would sort of be the everything test. You know, the most perhaps profound thing you can say is that the best for template that includes everything we know about these events is consistent with noise. And they did a bit more quantitative that they said, other than deviations that could be reabsorbed or absorbed in a redefinition of parameters, this signal doesn't support deviations from GL greater than 4%. In other words, if there were deviations in that signal greater than 4%, there would have been a detectable residual. Now, it might sound like this is, okay, it's a nice number, but just remember what this is implying about the physics of black holes. What went into that template is all the astonishing things that we've learned about black holes over the last 50, 100 years. We're seeing the late in spiral where there's this runaway decay of the orbit into coalescence. In this last stage, as was mentioned by Aaron, the luminosity is almost unimaginable. It's 25 orders of magnitude stronger than the binary pulsar. So we're in a completely different regime than previously tested. And then all of these other things that we've sort of learned about relativity are sort of encoded in this 4% statement. So we know that, or you know, if we assume cosmic censorship is true, we know in four dimensions, in general dimensions, black holes, horizons can't bifurcate. So we know that they had to merge together. When we did the numerical simulations, we found out that cosmic censorship actually does hold. So Hawking's no bifurcation theorem, the area increase theorems hold, and that's sort of in this data. We also see the astonishingly sort of rapid and simple transition from this in spiral to the ring down, and then we see this ring down to occur black hole. So all of this sort of amazing physics that we've learned about black holes is in that signal, and it's consistent to within 4%. Now, of course, relativity doesn't break up the in spiral into all of these things. It's just a four-dimensional space-time. But this is the way that sort of we think about these things, and of course, it's essential to our understanding of these mergers. And that's why it's also, I think, perhaps useful to try to say, well, how can we test these particular properties of space-time in these ways that we think about it? For instance, the uniqueness of black holes, the quasi-normal modes. And so now I'll sort of go over that, and Aaron already did do that, but let me just sort of explain how we can do that. So I'm going to say, let's sort of dissect the signal into various parts. And of course, what you'll see at the end of the day is that like 4% is a pretty strong constraint, but when we start taking the signal apart into various things, things get very weak. So we're not going to get a precision test of some of these ideas, but what I'm going to argue is that this is going to give us sort of the zeroth order test of the no-hair properties of black holes. So remember what the no-hair theorems are. So now just think of in vacuum space-time, it says that any stationary solution with an event horizon is uniquely characterized by the mass and spin of the black hole. So now what does that mean for a binary? Well, this is, it's not a stationary, but if these binaries are composed of black holes and they start, say initially, they're very far apart, because of the uniqueness theorems, the binary is also only characterized by a very small set of numbers. It's still the masses and the spins of these two black holes, and now there are a couple of extra numbers, say the relative orientations of the spin, and say some initial parameters of the binary. And we can assume that if these started very far apart, by the time they enter the LIGO band, they've circularized. So it's essentially just a few extra numbers. But given those numbers, because of the uniqueness theorems of black holes, it says that really the entire event, through the in-spiral merger ring down, is uniquely determined by that. There's really no choice for what's going to happen at any stage in the event. It's all predictable just by those set of numbers. So what Aaron sort of pointed out is that another consequence of the uniqueness theorems is if you know the mass and the spin of the black hole, you know the entire spectrum of all the quasi-normal modes that could be excited. So if you have a ring down, one way to sort of test it is the modes aren't independent. So if you measure one mode, you get the mass and the spin. If you can measure a second mode, it's a constraint, it's a test. And that's perfectly true if that's all you're going to be looking at. But because of these properties, what this is saying for a binary is if we can measure the properties of the initial parameters or the initial components of the black hole, that uniquely tells us what the final mass and spin of the remnant has to be. And then, you know, and then when we know that, the leading order ring down mode, it has no choice in how it oscillates and decays. And so that's an extra piece of data. That's a constraint that we can use then to test. And so that's what I'm claiming is sort of the zeroth order test of the no-hair properties. So let's sort of go through this. And I guess the other sort of fun thing about, you know, how loud the signal is all of these things you can just do with my level of experimental expertise, is just sort of counting peaks and measuring things on the paper, and you can get all of these numbers and get pretty decent estimates of all of this. So you don't have to do this. I mean, LIGO did a much more sophisticated analysis, and I'll show their plots, but you can just, you know, pencil and paper and measure all of these things. Yeah, but they're a few key peaks, and the errors. Yeah. But okay, so let me point out the various aspects of these signals that are going to give us this information. So, from the early IM spiral, the first thing that we can easily get is essentially the so-called chirp mass, and that's that is sort of a function of how the signal ramps up through time frequency space. So it's a consequence of the quadrupole nature of gravitational wave emission. And so, I mean, I guess you've all heard that if the leading order part of the gravitational wave signal for in-spiral is this very particular combination of the two masses of the black holes. And if that's all you know, then you've got this degeneracy. You know, you can't differentiate between the two masses. But at least the way in which the signal ramps up through time frequency gives you the chirp mass. But now if the merger is in-band, so they're going to spiral in, the merger is going to happen. It's going to sort of stop when they touch. And basically, that time scale is set by the sum of the two masses. So if you know when the merger happens, and here it's very clear where it happens, that frequency gives you the total mass of the system. So knowing sort of the way that it chirps through time frequency, at what point when they touch, that tells you the total mass. Now you can figure out the two masses, the two individual masses. So from this part of the in spiral, we've got some of the information to figure out what the properties of the final object have to be. What we still don't know yet just from this is what the two spins of the objects are. Now that's something that LIGO wasn't able to extract very accurately, and for a large reason, because there weren't very many cycles prior to Berger. So if there are, generically, if there are spins, the binary is going to precess. There are certainly degeneracies, but if you have a lot of cycles from the precession, the modulation of the waveform, you can sort of infer the spins of the objects. On the other hand, for this very crude zeroth order approximation, just from the fact that that when you sort of figure out that the two masses, from the chirp mass and the total mass, you know, you find that they are comparable masses. And we know that from relativity, if they're comparable masses from numerical simulations, when they merge, the orbital angular momentum just prior to merger essentially dominates the angular momentum of the final black hole. And this is sort of just to show from a set of simulations from the Caltech, Cornell, CETA, etc. collaboration spec, the XSS, I forget. There's a lot of universities involved. Sorry if I didn't say them all. But so what this is showing is the final dimensionless spin as a function of the spins. So these were looking at aligned equal mass. So that it spins various amounts of spins, either aligned or anti-aligned with the orbital angular momentum. So these are two Schwarzschild black holes that merge. The final black hole has a spin of 0.7. Now, if you add spins to the black hole in the sense of the orbital angular momentum, you can increase the spin of the final. It can go up to about 0.9. If you try to take away spin for the final black hole by adding spins opposite to the orbital angular momentum, you can get down to about 0.4. But there's no way you can actually get the spin to not be aligned with the orbital angular momentum or the dominant component of the spin. So yeah, there's a large sort of uncertainty in what the final spin is, but to a good approximation, it's going to be in the orbital angular momentum toward the end. So we're not going to get a very good handle on the spins, but we can sort of bound it perhaps to within 30% over the total possible range. Okay, so now we've got pretty decent estimates of the mass. We've got a pretty crude estimate of the final spin of the black hole. And now we can say, is that consistent with the ring down signal that Aaron spoke about? And then from the ring down, so it's at the one interesting, and I'll say that, go into this in a little bit more detail, but in some sense, all of this analysis that I'm using also uses the knowledge that we've gotten from the full numerical simulations, essentially telling us when we can assume that the horizons have merged, that's at the peak of the flux, and also that essentially immediately following the peak, this decay is essentially given by, the decay in the frequency following peak is essentially the leading order quasi-normal mode. I mean, really, in some sense, it's a whole family of quasi-normal modes that are excited. The higher overtones and the higher modes decay very, very rapidly. And also, there's no bizarre nonlinear phase going on. There's essentially a very quick transition. And so the numerical simulation says we don't have to wait very long. In fact, we immediately start measuring it to get an estimate of the quasi-normal modes. And so this, we can then invert the relationships to give us another independent estimate of the mass and the spin. And then this is sort of essentially the takeaway plot. And not, of course, they didn't do it as crudely as I described, but you basically get the same, to within a 50% measurement of consistency between sort of the fractions. So this is the fractional differences in the masses and the spins using the in spiral versus the ring down. This entire box is the entire range that GR allows. So of course it's a very crude measurement, but it really is an honest to goodness measurement. And you might not perhaps agree with me, but I really think that this is sort of the zeroth order piece of evidence that black holes are as described by Kerr black holes, the dynamics is described as general relativity, and they obey the No-Hare theorem. Okay, so now let's go to beyond general relativity. So, okay, this is a no anomaly was detected in the sense of the residual. The residual was consistent with noise. So you think, okay, so now we should be able to quite significantly constrain the zoo of alternative theories that people have proposed, and perhaps not quite as large a zoo, but there have been quite a few sort of exotic alternatives that people have that still survives despite various other observations that have ruled out a lot of possible exotica. For instance, boson stars, gravistars, traversable wormholes. These are still in principle viable exotic alternatives to GR. But now we finally have this pretty strong piece of data in the dynamical strong field of gravity, and it's consistent with GR, so we should be able to rule out these theories. But the problem is, as I mentioned before, is this really is the state of all exotic alternatives to vacuum mergers that are sort of viable alternatives. Now, this is sort of a famous plot by Kip Thorne from a few decades ago, and this was really to say the state of affairs before we were able to solve the merger problem using numerical simulations. And so people with a lot of work had figured out what the in spiral was, the ring down stuff, but this is a very nonlinear system, singularities form, and there were arguments back in the days, what is this regime going to look like? Some people argued the effect of one-body people, Thibaut de Moura, Alessandro Bonanno, that it would be as simple as it turned out to be. But of course, this is a very nonlinear system. There's no reason to suspect that generically this transition is going to be simple. But the problem with using this event to constrain alternatives is this is where most of the data is, and we just don't know. All our alternative theories are in the state. We just don't know what's going to happen in those alternatives. And perhaps just to illustrate sort of how little of the signal is really coming outside of the strong field. Again, this is again the data. So the two interferometers And now we're taking the best fit numerical relativity waveform overlaying it. You can see, you know, why it's a pretty good match. But the one thing that perhaps you don't immediately appreciate is how much of the early in spiral is being suppressed by the noise characteristics of LIGO. So this is the numerical relativity waveform applying those same bandpass filters as LIGO used for the data. And if we don't do that, so if we take a sort of a noise spectrum that's flat, so LIGO, you know, below about 30 hertz, it becomes a very, you know, the noise becomes very, very large, but that's where most of the signal is. But if you imagine that LIGO had a flat noise curve, this is actually what the in-spiral waveform would look like. So of course, there's a tremendous, you know, amount of information in the early in-spiral if LIGO could go to low frequencies, but because of the noise characteristics, it's strongly suppressed, and the only bit that comes through is really smack dab from that the dynamical strong field regime. So this is where all of the data is. If you understand this part of your alternative theory, you're kind of out of luck. But that's essentially where we are right now in terms of studies of alternative theories. So pretty much where these things have been worked out has been either in this early in-spiral phase, where post-Newtonian-like properties of alternative theories have been developed, and Nico's going to focus a lot about that. Or on the other side, where in various either exotic alternatives to GR, to black holes within GR, or in these alternative theories, where the equivalent black hole-like solutions have been found, people have sort of looked at perturbations of those to sort of understand the ring down properties. But again, you know, because of the noise characteristics of the detector, most of that SNR of 24 is coming from this regime where there's no information in those alternative theories. So I think at the very least, and perhaps the take-home point, rather than the constraints that I'm going to sort of hand wave at and some of the ones that Nico will, you know, say a bit more quantitatively, is that this event has really raised the bar for all alternative theories and exotic objects. They really have to understand the merger regime now. They can't get away with just the perturbative calculations on either side. So I think that this can be considered sort of an opportunity for interesting work going into the future to you know, if you've got your favorite theory, your favorite exotic alternative, now there's this exquisite piece of data that you can confront it with. So in the last little bit of my talk, what I'm going to talk about is at least doing sort of a heuristic constraint on some alternatives. And what I'm going to try to argue is that now I'm just going to focus on the subsets of alternatives, these exotic compact object alternatives within general relativity. What I'm going to argue is that even though we don't know this regime in these exotic alternatives, but that this aspect of it, this ring down that Aaron spoke about, I think very strongly suggests that even if you want to play devil's advocate and say that the two initial objects were ultra-compact boson stars, gravistars, whatever, that this data is telling us that they promptly collapsed to a Kerr black hole. And I think it'd be very, very bizarre if they formed a large exotic compact object. So again, because I don't know this regime, it's not going to be a quantitative discussion, but I'm going to try to argue, at least heuristically, why that's the case. Basically, the bottom line is, so this is now within general relativity, this is some exotic matter that forming a compact object. The question is, so these things, they collide, it's a very violent collision, it's essentially happening at half the speed of light. All kinds of matter that we know, if you smash two objects together with such large energies, you're going to excite violent oscillations in the matter. This is now still within GR. These violent oscillations are going to produce gravitational waves, and so you should see the remnants of those oscillations here after the event. And the fact that it's not there says that essentially you have to come up with an exotic material that can damp all oscillations to within, you know, the noise level of LIGO within a light crossing time of the object, which implies that these objects essentially have to be as viscous as black holes, which is, I think, it would be a pretty bizarre kind of matter that would be able to do that. And let me another way to think about how bizarre these things would be, or why this I think is a reasonable conclusion, is at least there are a couple of compact objects in GR, where we do know what the outcome is. They have been studied well, and these are neutron star mergers. Okay, so they're not quite as compact as black holes, but they're getting close there. And also boson stars, and the kinds of boson star mergers that people have looked at so far, also neutron star-like compact, so not quite compact enough for these objects. But we know in these two cases what happens is generically there are two outcomes. One, as I mentioned before, there's prompt collapse to a black hole, and that's the case that I think, you know, heuristically is at least possible, you know, Dale's advocate is consistent with this data. But then again, from where when these things don't form a black hole, then as I mentioned before, huge oscillations in the dynamics of these matter fields is set up, and these would have been observable. So one way to try to characterize that is to try to map the problem, just to sort of isolate how bizarre the matter would be, is to try to sort of try to map the observed damping time scale and frequency to effective viscosities of a hydrodynamic model. So I'm not saying that this exotic matter has to be fluid-like, but I'm saying one way in which we can sort of understand sort of what the effective properties of this matter is to be, says, is if it were a fluid star, what would its viscosities have to be consistent with this result? So essentially mapping the problem to an effective hydrodynamic model. So this has been worked out, you know, a long time ago. If we just took just an incompressible Newtonian fluid star, again, it's not saying that these are Newtonian fluid objects, but just mapping the problem to that to give some intuitive sense for how bizarre the exotic matter has to be. And so it's essentially saying that if we're taking, you know, objects with these, the observed masses, the characteristic scale of the final remnant that we get from the signal, the observed damping time, these are the effective shear and bulk viscosities that the material will have to be consistent with the signal. So to give you some sense of what that means for some known objects, so for black holes, we could use the membrane paradigm or these fluid hydrodynamic correspondences. And we can see that the effective, okay, so of course black holes aren't in this sense like an Newtonian fluid, and that's why there's some bizarre properties such that they have negative bulk viscosities. But at this order of magnitude, you can see black holes are consistent with those numbers, which of course it has to be. If these are curved black holes, they damp like this. Just to give you some ideas for other kinds of matter in which we can compute these things, if we look at neutron stars, well, first of all, you can see that if we ignore magnetic fields, the shear viscosity is very low in neutron stars. And these are sort of typical numbers that people have seen in simulations. And of course, with neutron star materials, we can't go to the 30 solar masses, but this is if there was neutron star-like material out there. The bulk viscosities are relatively, you know, it's starting to approach the right order of magnitude. But the point is that both of these viscosities have to be that large to explain this object. So one way you could imagine a neutron star-like material of getting there is if they're very, very large magnetic fields. So with magnetic breaking, if you have, well, this will say that you'd perhaps need a magnetic field of like 10 to the 17, 10 to the 18 Gauss, you might be able to get neutron star-like material to have the effect of shear viscosity. But even then, that might not be enough. So what with magnetized neutron star mergers, if we assume that the objects don't have such very, very large magnetic fields to begin with, they have various dynamo mechanisms, Kelvin-Helmholtz instabilities, etc., where you can grow magnetic fields pretty large post-merger. But remember, with this, to explain the signal, it immediately essentially has to have those super magnetar-like strengths to immediately start damping it down. So you might say that, well, neutron stars, well, highly magnetized neutron stars are getting close, but actually they're still a few orders of magnitude away, the ones that we are familiar with. Boson stars are also a few orders of magnitude away. And interestingly, with bosonic matter, this is not any intrinsic viscosity in the bosonic matter. Essentially, if it weren't for gravity, you sort of perturb a boson star, it will have a very high Q factor. It will oscillate for a very long period of time. This is essentially gravitational wave damping. So again, these are exotica, but within GR. So these oscillating modes are going to emit gravitational waves, and it's really gravitational wave damping that's giving this effect of viscosity. So in some sense, this is sort of the lower limit on the viscosity in exotic alternatives within general relativity, just due to gravitational wave damping. Okay, so let's give you some sort of some sense of objects that we know. But perhaps a different, more useful way to look at this argument is to flip it around. And it's saying that, okay, let's assume that this was an exotic compact object merger, and now, just for whatever reason, this part of the signal, there's some other effect that causes. So imagine, like one thing you can imagine might cause this sort of damping is, so we have non-singular, non-horizon, there are no horizons here, these are just compact objects. Initially, there's a very strong quadrupole moment. There's almost, you know, from this perspective, in this regime, they're almost like point particles moving around, so a strong quadrupole moment. But then they start to merge, and let's say they sort of blend into each other, and there's just going to be a reduction in the quadrupole moment. And let's assume just that that is what's causing this thing. But of course, now they're also sort of plunging, so now there's going to be some matter oscillations excited. So let's ask, if they were an exotic compact object with a particular sort of... Oh, so on the left hand side. Right, so what?
There would be a lovely point on the right hand side, but you don't see for the same reason. You don't see the stuff on the left
hand side. Okay, so perhaps I should explain this a bit more carefully. So on this left hand side, what I'm assuming is that this signal is a binary in spiral.
Yeah.
So whatever it happens to be in its exotic compact object, it's a binary in spiral. And now I'm going to just say this is whatever it is, but now let's just look at this right hand side.
Right? Yeah. Saying everything decays very fast, but I'm saying that's not real. That's just an artifact of the filtering.
Oh wait, no. So the filtering is affecting the low frequencies here.
Yes, exactly.
So right, yes, okay. So if a long-lived low frequency mode is excited, yes, you're right. Then it will be filtered out. But if something on, so this is sort of implying that there's at least going to be damping on a time scale of the light crossing time. And so if there are modes that are around this regime in frequency, and I'll also plot soon.
I'm just saying that that's a loophole, that if there are long-lived low-frequency modes, then this data is blind.
Yes, yeah, right. And that's why I'm saying that that's why this is not a very concrete conclusion, it's heuristic. Because if we knew what was going on, then we'd know exactly what set of frequencies are excited. And for instance, with neutron stars and boson stars, it typically is very high. It's frequencies that are commensurate with sort of, well, even slightly higher than the final orbital frequency. But yeah, you're right. But let's sort of, yes. Yeah. So, if I'm understanding your question, so something like how compact do these things have to be? So, if there's some transition from Schwarzschild-like on the outside to some matter, at what scale can that happen? And I think this, so again, because we're not quite sure with this thing, but I suspect if these arched objects aren't close to Schwarzschild-like in compactness, you would start to see that this would smooth out before the peak. So for example, with say like neutron stars, at Schwarzschild outside, perhaps 6M, say, for instance. And with two neutron stars at merger, you know, at some point over here, you'd start to see a difference already. So I think this, the fact that it's really going up to the peak that's consistent with black holes is showing, if I were to guess, it's somewhere between 2 to 3M that there could conceivably be a transition. But if it were much larger than about 3M, I'm guessing, it would already be inconsistent with this in-spiral bit. So they have to be quite close to Schwarzschild to match this part. Okay, so let's sort of flip that analysis around a little bit, and let's assume, okay, this mode is, it's there for whatever reason, But now a matter mode is being excited, and you can pick the frequency of the least damped mode and the oscillation time. So, the frequency and the damping time of the least damped matter mode that's excited. And the question is, the fact that it's not observed, can we limit the amplitude of the excitation of that mode? And let's normalize it relative to this peak. And that's what this plot shows here. So here it's essentially, pick the frequency, pick the damping time. And this what this analysis was doing is it was saying, well, we've got that, sort of looking for two modes. We've got that dominant mode, which is this is the one from the Kerr black hole, around 250 hertz, 4 millisecond damping time. And now we've got another mode that's given by these. And this is the amplitude above which LIGO should have seen it. And just an artifact of this two mode analysis, we have got complete degeneracy here. So we can't really say anything about modes that are exactly the same damping times and frequencies of LIGO. But now it's saying, like, so yeah, and also we put in a prior that it's got to be a higher frequency. But similarly, like if you went very much lower, these contours would become bad. But for example, let me just pick the boson star case. So with boson stars, well, these so-called solitonic boson stars that I used this for, they've got effective frequencies of around 300 hertz and damping times of about several hundred milliseconds. So those solitonic boson stars, the leading damped matter mode would sit somewhere up there. And so what this is saying is that if the amplitude of that mode was larger than 3% of this leading quasi-normal mode, LIGO should have seen it. You'd have to do this with these solitonic boson stars to figure out how large the matter oscillations are. But if the existing neutron star and boson star simulations are giving any guidance, I'd say it's about an order of magnitude larger than this. So that's what I'm saying. Like, heuristically, I think these kinds of matter models that, again, if their dominant frequencies are in this range, this would rule them out. So just to conclude, and then I guess I'm running out of time, and I think that people want to go and have lunch, and also the LIGO is announcing at 1:15 the next set of data, so people want to go and get their laptop set up to listen to that conference. So I'll just stop with this first page of conclusions. But so I think the obvious thing is that, you know, these heuristic arguments that I had just made, to make them concrete, we'd really need to solve the two-body problem in these alternative theories. And that's going to hold also for what Nico is going to talk about, not in exotic alternatives within GR, but actually differences from GR. The two-body problem has to be understood to confront with this data. At least for these exotic alternatives, I'd say with boson stars, that's going to be pretty straightforward. It's a well-posed theory, well-posed systems of equations. It might be challenging to come up with a boson star potential that is sufficiently compact. So what's been done is sort of with boson stars that are more neutron star-like compaction, but in principle, that's done. I would say that the fact that this data is out there now makes objects like these gravistars and traversable wormholes. I'm not trying to pick on. Well, I guess I am sort of picking on these kinds of objects, but I'd say from a theoretical perspective, they're dead in the water in the sense that there's no theory behind how these objects form. There's no theory for how their dynamics work. So you can't even formulate a problem to understand how they merge. Not that that's impossible to do, and I'm sure that there are some very creative theorists who might be able to come up with such a theory, but they're not even theories at this moment. I think before this event, you know, you could have said, well, we'll deal with that issue when we get the data. Well, here's the data, you have to deal with it. And until that case, these objects aren't even, I don't think they should be considered anymore. But this data is not going away. And as I said, we don't even have to, I'm not sure what LIGO is going to announce, but it doesn't have to be anything spectacular because this data is there. And the kind of constraints that we should be able to put on alternative theories is going to be getting better, the better that we can understand alternative theories just with this one GW150914. So thank you for your time.
I just wanted to make a comment about alternative gravity theories. in a alternative gravity theory published, the modified black holes are such that in the calculation of the strain, H, G always multiplies M, also the Chirp mass. So if you increase G, you lower the M, and you also lower the spin, because the spin is inversely proportional to G.
Yeah.
So, but then it turns out you can still fit the final merger waveform given one of your numerical calculations.
Yeah. So perhaps I didn't emphasize this enough, but so this 4% constraint that LIGO does doesn't include theories where you can fit the data by changing the parameters of the system. So for example, like you say, like if somehow G is different by a factor of two, you know, the masses could be different by a factor of two, and that would not be inconsistent with this data. So it's really just changes that can't be absorbed into a redefinition of the parameters of the binary through whatever mechanism, but that's a good point.
This can make a difference to the final picture.
Also, with this one event, those theories can't be constrained. But for instance, if this sort of something like just a Newton's constant, which changes the scale of all black hole mergers, then you'd have to. It would be if things, for instance, once a population of events are observed, perhaps the mass distribution doesn't make sense from an astrophysical perspective, and then you might have to consider those. But I think in a lot of theories, one event you might be able to explain by redefining parameters. But now if you have a population that sample different masses and different spins, the redefinitions would have to depend on the system. And I think with a collection of objects, you'd start to notice such effects, especially with this PPE-type framework that Nico will talk about.
For with 100 events, you can start concentrating on.
Yeah.
Any other question?
So, I mean, you kind of pick on these really exotic objects that don't live in a very well-motivated theory.
Yeah.
I would just advocate for taking the advice you gave us in the beginning, which is that there are two strong field regimes of gravity in cosmology on horizon scales and then near horizons of black holes.
Yeah.
And, you know, people have made a major effort to try and formulate at least somewhat consistent theories of infrared modifications of gravity that are relevant on horizon scales. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a little bit unknown what the compact objects even are in these theories. But that might be a better place to put the effort. Start with the well-motivated theories and then figure out what the objects are.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, and I didn't want to mean to be too disparaging to alternative theories in general. So what I can say is that this is an opportunity as well. So the one comment I will have that is a bit disparaging is I think that there are too many theories that, it's almost like there are too many weeds out there. And this event can be an excellent event to sort of do some gardening. And what we could be left with are general relativity and a few well-motivated, well-posed alternative theories that can then be developed further. And perhaps, I think what this event is saying is that at least on these scales, general relativity is pretty correct. But it's not saying that it's the correct theory. There might be differences, there might be deviations, and those we will hopefully start to discover. In some sense, how strongly we can say that perhaps we've discovered some hairy black holes or something that's a bit different, or how strongly we can rule an alternative out is, we have this data. It's an amazing piece of data that should be used to prune your theories or find a way to make it consistent with GR. And so that was sort of more the comment, is it's an opportunity to really delve into the two-body problem in alternative theories.
So maybe just make a comment on that. So part of the well-motivated theory should be that one of the motivations should be a well-posed theory. And 99% of those are not well posed. And so to then try to use them in a nonlinear regime, then there is nothing you can do there. So that would be my call for.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so let's thank Franz again.
Thank you.